enter if you dare this ghastly conversation of teens fraught with despair and recent lacerations. Final girl, chase after her, don't let her get away. But first, the Slumber Podcast Massacre.
Welcome to Slumber Podcast Massacre with TNA.
That's Tim.
That's Andy.
And this is a podcast about horror.
Ooh. Every week, Tim and I get together. We talk about a different movie from the horror genre, from your well-known classic down to that rare gem that created slugs
at the back of your video store shelf. This week, it's my birthday, goddammit.
Woo.
And I chose, maybe a loose fit into our niche podcast idea, but it's technically the first movie to ever scare the fuck out of me. So I think it's worth talking about. Plus, it features pure evil from 1981. It's Time Bandits. Tim, if you could go back in time, who would you rob? Who's got that one thing from history you want?
Yeah, that's great. That's an excellent question.
We can talk about Python later.
Yeah, oh sure, yeah. We'll definitely get there. Okay. See, I'm having a Stay Puft Marshmallow Man moment here because like literally the first thing that popped into my mind was I'm going to go back to 1987 and steal the guitar from Slumber Party Massacre Part 2.
Yeah, that's fine. That's a good answer.
I mean, it would only mean anything to me. I think on eBay, the original fetched like $400. Yeah. So I could probably do better. I would say that I'm sort of a collector of I'm fascinated not by necessarily like high tech when it comes to like I have the best sound system or I have the greatest speakers or whatever. Like to me, like I like a first edition of a book.
Yeah.
Like to me, that's cool. So I would say then
you don't want to read the book though.
No, okay. No, God, no. Okay. Yeah. Thank no, God. There's right. tapes for that. I would, I know that there's more valuable stuff like way, way, way far back. But I honestly would probably have to go with something that like stirs me more in a modern sense. So if I had, let's say, I think I'd like, and the thing is like that you can find these things anywhere. I would like maybe like the sheet of music that Prince wrote Purple Rain on.
Ooh, there you go.
Like the actual paper that he like plucked the notes down on.
Yeah.
Like to me, that would be cool. Like to think of this song that everybody in the world knows and be like, this is the paper with the ink that actually made the song that everyone knows.
Yeah.
And so that to me would be cool. It wouldn't be so much about the monetary value, while I'm sure that would fetch plenty. It's more about the significance of its singularity that like, cause here's the thing. There, I could go back and say, I want this Fabergé egg. There are other Fabergé eggs out there to have.
Yeah.
But nobody's going to say, I too have, he wrote with both his left and right hand simultaneously and transcribed Purple Rain. No, there's one. So that would be my thing. Something that was meaningful that way. Then again,
anything outside the 20th century?
I was about to go to.
You have a map.
Okay, right, exactly.
All time of the universe.
Yeah, because immediately I was going, I'm thinking like James Dean's Red Jacket.
That's where I was going next. I was going to ask you if you would take James Dean jacket.
Yeah, the red fucking jacket from Rebel Without a Cause would be, I mean, it's at the Holy Grail. And we're not even talking about Python yet. But so I would say, okay, so I'll meet you there. Like if we're talking about all time, I would say, you'd have to go for the gusto. You'd have to say like almost biblical.
Yeah.
Like if you had like I don't want to insult anybody, but like a nail from the cross on Golgotha, which translates to Hill of the Skull. That would be like, I mean, who's going to top that?
Yeah.
Like, this was the nail through, whether you believe it or not, the person they called Jesus.
Right.
That would be, now, I don't know.
Don't you want to go get the Barabbas one, though, just to be like, yeah, I could have.
Right, exactly.
Well, where's the fun in that?
Yeah, because Barabbas is like a B-side, you know, right, like yeah. A rare... Like, yeah, you could have, like, you know, Let's Spend the Night Together, but, like, you know, Play with Fire is a way cooler song. And I'm not even a big Stones fan, but it is. But no, like, that would be something. But I'll tell you this. Now, let me just say this, because it's such a great question that I can't wait to turn it over to you. I hope you've been thinking about this.
Oh, yeah, kind of.
But I do. I'm going to admit, I'm a Leo. And part of what makes Leos is if we're not actors or lawyers or getting an audience in front of people, we like shiny things.
Yeah.
We like bright, shiny, fancy things. So I would love a rare jewel. I think that would be really cool. Like if I was really going for the money. And I probably don't know history well enough right. to even name what that jewel would be, right. but I'm sure that there's probably a diamond yeah. that it like, maybe like.
When you play it right, you could go back in time and buy the mine that jewel comes from, probably for dirt cheap, like before anyone knew it was a mine, a diamond mine or yeah. whatever, a jewel mine.
Give the man a go. Fish he eats for a day.
Exactly.
Right.
Give a man a time portal.
Yeah. And he's pure evil. And James Dean's cold. But no, I would, yeah, I'd go for like something. I'd go for something. Oh God, you know what I'd do? I'm such a just nerd. I wouldn't even go for like a real jewel. I'd go for like the prop necklace in Titanic. Like that's, if I'm being honest with myself, I mean, for all things fair,
I got you to expand yourself and then you're like, no,
yeah,
no,
it's kind of back in time.
1998.
Right. Yeah, doesn't get any better than 98, baby. So tell me what you would go get.
I mean, I can't think of anything specific, but it would probably be something that was like the first in as far as like our advancement as a species, like the first hieroglyphic or the first smelted ore that someone made a mold and poured hot metal into it.
Yeah.
They were probably like, this is garbage, but I'd be like, that's the first one though.
Yeah.
You have no idea what this is going to do.
Yeah, if you went to a smelted ore party, you'd be like, wait till you see this. So, okay, no, but the first of something.
Yeah. The well, first so we'll printed page.
Yeah, yeah. Which would be China?
Maybe, I don't I know. I don't so. Know my history of the printed know, maybe, page very maybe. Well.
But like, because you could like... I'm just thinking like 2001, like you'd like to say like the first tool that man well, picked yeah. up, but it's probably like a bone, like a jawbone.
Sure, but it, yeah. And that it feels more objective. Like I was, you know, because I was going to think like, ooh, the first piece of art, but art is subjective. Like no one, people made art before they knew it was art. You know what I'm saying?
Okay, what about this then? What about, God, could, and maybe somebody out there can answer this question. It, would there be such a thing, and maybe it is all the way, it's probably hieroglyphics, but what would be like the first math equation expressed in written form?
Ooh, there you go. Yeah.
What would that even be? I don't know. I don't like.
We find out it's,
we're going to get this third mic rigged up.
I'm trying to think of, oh, God, now I can't even think of the actor's name. The guy who's crazy with math, and they kicked him out of the MCU. Terrence Howard.
Oh, okay.
What does he do? Like, one times one is two or something like that? He's got some crazy, like, it's a very obvious equation, and he's just like, nope, that's not true.
You could do the Unabomber's hoodie. That would be kind of awesome.
Oh.
Remember you had that hoodie with the glasses?
Yeah.
I mean, it's math related.
Yeah.
But no, that would be cool. Like, I mean, I see what you're saying. Like, right. The first instance of, like, something being birthed into existence.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Like, the first joke ever written.
Yeah.
Which probably sucks.
Right.
But I mean,
yeah, the thing you're stealing is not going to be of any quality.
Yeah.
No one's like, here's the first goblet. Oh, perfect. Put it in a museum.
Right. Yeah. Like, there's something to be said for improvement.
Yes.
You know. But the first would be cool. No, that's such a neat question.
Like, the first, you know, when a business will frame that first dollar, I'm going to frame the first whatever leaf or whatever was used as currency.
Yeah.
That I'd love.
Right. The first beaver pelt.
Yeah. The first thing that was traded for something else. I don't know. Who knows?
That, yes. No,
which would probably just be a rock or, right. Yeah, like a orange.
Yeah, I was going to say, or a person, but hopefully it's not.
No,
it's
that was
not
much that, later.
Right? Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, no, not that. But yeah, like, no, that is fascinating to think about. And here's the other fascinating part is, and I'm not going to be all like curmudgeon-y about this, but it starts to beg the question of how many of these things will we have as we move more into a digital age? Because the first example of anything digital might in fact be, I mean, I guess if there was a computer guy, there would be a way to quantify that's the server address that it came from or something.
Sure,
I don't know.
Yeah.
But I mean, but
some sort of hidden electronic stamp.
Yeah. Somebody else is going to turn around from his screen and be like, oh, you mean this? Like, yeah,
right.
This thing that I just pulled up as well. So, yeah, like, as I think I like tangible stuff. I love magazines. I love, you know, weapons.
Two of my favorite things.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you know this. I announced it on Facebook as of, like, in the last fortnight.
Uh-huh.
Chinese stars are now legal in the state of Indiana.
Oh, thank God, getting things done, Indiana.
Interestingly named because they came from Japan, but I mean, we didn't know any better. It was a different time. But I, like I said on Facebook, like I am now, you know.
Yeah, wow, I've never really thought about that before.
Right, it's shuriken, and it is a very much Japanese implement. It's a ninja star.
Yeah.
Ninjas are from Japan. Yeah, no longer do I have to hide the dirty little secret of massacring so many innocent telephone poles. That's just wide out in the open now. So, no, but I like tangible stuff. I like books. I like magazines. I like objects. I like, does going to a museum do anything for you?
Yeah.
You like it?
I like going to a museum.
Yeah. Do you have, now here we are, everybody knows by now that we're in the vicinity of Chicagoland. Do you have a preference between the museum, the Field Museum, which is a museum of history,
yeah,
and the what's the other one?
Science and Industry?
Yes.
I mean, Science and Industry is more fun. I've been to that one way more times. But the last time I went to the Field Museum, I was like, damn, this place kind of rules. Like,
that's
there
the one
is
with
so much stuff in there. And it feels more cohesive than Science and Industry. And Industry is, it's almost too, you know, some of the stuff is too hands-on. So it feels like a play zone. I know some of it literally is. But yeah, do you know what they do with the chicks that are hatched there?
No.
You know, they've got at the Museum of Science and Industry, there's a little incubation exhibit.
Uh-huh.
Show you the different stages of chicken egg. And then they have actual chicken. You can watch chickens be hatched.
Yeah.
They feed them to the animals at the Lincoln Park Zoo.
Wow. Yeah. Well, enjoy it while you're there, folks.
Yeah, and I can't remember the number of chicks that they hatch, but it's a decent amount. I mean, it's a good little partnership they got going there.
Wow.
Yeah.
You ever seen the chicks that they have over at TSC, Tractor Supply Company?
No.
Yeah, they've got a little like plastic bin over there of like little chickens, and I have no idea what those are used for.
Oh,
it's
wow.
literally in a, for those of you who don't know, that we live in Indiana. And there is such a thing.
Celebrate
called,
it, Tim. Don't say it.
Yes. Down it's like a that. Tractor supply store. And they have like a plastic bin of chickens, like little baby chickens.
Wow.
Under like heat lamps. Okay. I don't know what they're for.
But anyway, yeah, Field Museum. I want to go back to the Field Museum. Like if I had to pick between them right now, I would go Field Museum.
I had a moment at the Field Museum. I was taking a little tour, and I was going into one of the longhouses, one of the native houses structures. And they held up, there was a group of, I don't know, maybe 15 of us or whatever. And they held up this object, and they said, "Does anybody know what this is?" And it was dead silence. And they said, you know, bear in mind that this tribe, you know, that this was picked up from the edge of a hill. And I just raised my hand and I said, "That's a sled." And everybody turned and looked at me like, "How did you know this?" And I'm like, "Look, it's not even fair. I'm sorry, right. guys. Like, it's my
no
people.
No one saw your skin."
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's brown. But no, like it is a great museum. We're lucky to live there. And you know what's so weird about it is that museum was literally just built for the World's Fair. Like, let's build this giant structure of concrete and massive structure, by the way, just for like a fair.
Yeah.
Crazy.
You know why I've been to Science and Industry more? Parking's easier there. Like, they've just got a very easy in and out parking garage. It's more on the south. It's much further south. So it's not in the museum campus with the planetarium and the aquarium. It's kind of its own thing.
Do you like the Art Institute?
Yo, I love the Art Institute. Yeah.
You ever go by the Ferris Bueller's Day Off, like those windows?
Yeah.
There's the windows and then there's the painting.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah. You got to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to do all the bits.
Yeah, oh, sure, sure. No, it's great. Well, here we both like old things then.
Yeah.
So that's nice. And it's nice to hear from you too, because I know that you appreciate technology and advancement that way, but yet you still have an appreciation for the origin of those things.
Oh,
so that's
sure.
cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. I kind of feel like as we're sitting here talking about this, I'm like, somebody is screaming like the perfect thing to go back and get. Like, but it's just not. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's all subjective, but I mean, I feel
right
like
right now Nancy is screaming, "He doesn't like going to museums."
I do. Right. But, well, I mean, yeah, well, I mean, you've got plans for next weekend then.
Yeah.
There you go. But no, I feel
here's
like.
Here's the thing. I'll go to any museum, but I'm never like, "Ooh, there's a museum in town. Let's go."
I remember when I was a kid, like, I thought it was such hot shit, like, because you'd take school trips there, right?
Yeah.
And I was like just oozing my fucking genius out. Because I'm like, here's what you do. You go to the gift store, you pick up a pair of those Debonair brand binoculars that swing out, and then you can stand in one place and just look around. You see all of it. You don't have to walk over there. You got the binocs. I just thought I was like a fucking, like, just super genius right. for that. Yeah. I just really wanted
There's
the binoculars.
There's no advantage to looking at a painting close up. Nothing no. to see there.
Right. I had weird stage. I mean, did you ever have weird stages of collecting things? I had a binocular stage. I had a flashlight stage.
Oh.
A magnet stage.
Nothing like that. No.
No? You collected like normal things?
Well,
like comic
I mean,
books?
Like, it's probably always like some sort of pop culture thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I get are Three Stooges things or Marx Brothers for 2 years.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Of your collection, since we're talking about like treasured things, do you have it at, like on your person that you're comfortable with saying?
Yeah.
Do you have a collection that even if it's not like the most valuable thing that you're like, "I have all of this thing and it is like my treasure"?
No. Not any. No. No.
Do you have all of Zappa's material?
No. He's put out so much.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have, you used to have everything, every single thing that Python did?
Yeah.
Speaking of those guys.
That was something I did try to amass, and I feel like I got.
You had
most
that one great CD set.
The Final Cut ones.
Yeah, they were like different colored.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, they did have a bigger
box set.
And it
had everything on, like all the Flying Circus.
Yeah, I didn't realize that they had so many albums that they put out. Like, that's what was crazy. And we can make a nice little transition
into
Monty Python. Should we do the shtick and then get into some Monty Python?
Let's do the shtick.
Okay. Let's we'll do the Wikipedia facts. This is Time Bandits from 1981. It was written by Terry Gilliam and Michael Palin, directed by Terry Gilliam. It stars Craig Warnock, David Rappaport, and David Warner. It had a budget of $5 million. It pulled in $42 million. Let's do Nan Sum, and then we'll get into some spoilers. Kevin is an 11-year-old boy whose love for history is overshadowed by his parents' love for their kitchen appliances. One night, a knight on horseback surprisingly busts from his wardrobe, disappearing into his wall. So the next night, Kevin attempts to capture proof of the knight, but instead a small group of dwarves emerges from his wardrobe. Wikipedia used dwarves. That's how I'm going to go for the rest of the episode, folks. Strap in!
A small group, you say?
You know, it didn't mean to sound redundant.
Oh, okay.
Actually, yeah.
Aren't they all? Right, go ahead.
Soon after, a giant floating head appears in his room, and Kevin and the group escape through Kevin's bedroom wall, sending them tumbling into Napoleonic-conquered Italy. As it turns out, the dwarves are actually employees of the Supreme Being and are using a map of time holes to rob famous figures throughout history. But their exploits do not go unnoticed. Pure evil, trapped in the fortress of eternal darkness, has been watching the group and intends to steal the map, giving him access to the world and the technological advancements it contains. Now Kevin must try and fight against evil and get back home or become a permanent member of the Time Bandits.
Mm.
That was a little clunky getting to that.
No, you're fine. You know what, and I don't know if Napoleonic is the origin of the Neapolitan. It's probably two different things.
Maybe.
You're familiar with the ice cream.
Yeah.
It absolutely sucks dick compared to the Italian one of the three ice creams with the cherries in it.
Oh, yes. I know what you're talking about.
What is that?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Yes. So, Time Bandits. Now, this is an interesting one.
Yeah.
It's your birthday. And I appreciate that. I am happy for your birth, and I know that you were excited about this movie. I struggle with this because I struggle with fantasy movies. I have some that I like. I love Legend. I love Neverending Story.
Yeah.
But I fall asleep at every single episode of Game of Thrones. I am not a huge fan of the whole Lord of the Rings thing. We're losing listeners as I speak. I'm just like Willow. It's just not a genre that really grabs me for whatever reason. Yeah. And that's the reason.
It's hit or miss for me too.
Okay. Do you like Legend?
But I'm not like Legend.
Well, right.
I'm more like, wow, the makeup on Tim Curry is incredible.
Well,
but
yes.
Do I want to watch the whole movie? I don't know.
That's fair. So I'm thinking of this movie, and I'm literally all the way back in my mind to when this would have, not in the theaters, but would have been first on like HBO or something like that.
Yeah.
Which seems like it was pretty quick and seemed like it was pretty often. I mean, this movie was on a lot, was it not?
I had it on tape, so okay. I watched the tape all the time.
So I was sitting around in a basement in a bi-level. I love a good bi-level basement. And I was sitting down there because that's where all the fun happens. And I was down there. There was Pong, which ruled. And then these older kids were watching Time Bandits while my parents visited with their parents upstairs. And I remember it being dirty and like muddy, and I couldn't understand it. And I just like tuned out for 40 years. And then it was your birthday. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to fucking watch Time Bandits. And I don't know. And I mean, I'm even taking into account things that are put across as spectacles of filmmaking. I don't know if within the constraints of the budget, if I've ever seen a more ambitious film in my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that if nothing else, you have to give it credit for its scope of imagination.
I totally agree. And that is something I noticed rewatching it now for the 150,000th time.
So here's the question to you then. If this movie scared you so much the first time you saw it, and you said in the theater.
Well, okay, yes. And so that was more, it was a reaction, is a very specific thing that happened.
Yeah.
This didn't scare me like Ghostbusters scared me.
Okay.
So yeah, here's the scenario. We're talking very early memories because I was 4 or 5 when this came out. I felt like 4, but I would have had to have been 5 when this came out. Either way, because I'm 2 years older than my brother, and I remember my mom putting me on the phone, and my dad was on the phone, and he's like, "Hey, I want to take you to a movie tonight, but don't tell your brother. Like, I'm not going to take him. I'm just going to take you."
Ooh.
And I was like, "Whoa." Like, since this little turd has entered my life, this is the first time I've gotten to do something without him. I love my brother very much. That was a joke. I probably felt that way at the time, though.
He's a patron.
Yeah, he is a patron. He just had a birthday. Happy birthday. So I was like, oh, man. I mean, this was, you know, one of the first, like, big moments of my short life. And I remember going to the theater. Like, the movie kind of starts, and he's like, "Hey, you want popcorn?" And I'm like, "Yeah." So he gets up and leaves, right? So there I am, 5 years old, sitting in the movie. And within 45 seconds in this movie, you have a horse out of nowhere busting out of a little boy's bedroom, something I could relate very well to.
It's shocking.
It's shocking. And I was, boom, up the aisle, fucking screaming. Like, I remember just busting through those doors like
the horse.
Yes, exactly. And just my dad being like, "Oh, hey, what's going on?" Because if you remember the general cinema, how it was set up.
Sure.
I didn't even know what theater we were in. If you're looking at it, it's the one in the back left corner.
Okay.
If you're standing in the lobby looking back left corner.
Yeah.
So come busting out of that one. And he's like in line, like, "What's going on?" You know, have I struggled at points in my life going, did he do that on purpose? Did he know? You know, I don't think so. I like to think not. But like that was one of my first like huge scares and like traumatic like movie moments. Not to say that things later in the movie didn't creep me out, but it certainly wasn't like I watched Ghostbusters with my hands over my eyes. So, yeah, as far as scaring me, it was really, I mean, that scene.
So here's the thing, you mentioned the rest of the movie. The thing that's interesting about Terry Gilliam is, aside, I mean, of course, we're going to talk a lot about the setting and the aesthetics, because he has an instantly recognizable style, and it's not even style, it's just, he has a, this is a beautiful thing to say. You can recognize this man's imagination on screen.
There you go.
And it is Terry Gilliam's, and you know it as soon as you see it, and it's really unique to this world. But in addition to that, on a technical side, what he considers like a long lens for filmmaking is like the average lens.
Right.
The lens that he likes to use is about less than half of the sort of scope that is a normal length of lens. So he likes a wide lens, but very, very close. So you get this weird sort of distorted, hallucinogenic almost feel to all of his scenes.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't feel like I'm going to set it off a little bit and make it pretty. It's at a distance that I can enjoy. It's more up close and a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And it really shines through in this. And you're right, I even sort of remember you telling that story, and when that fucking horse jumped out, I like literally was like, "Huh!" Like, Jesus Christ, like nobody prepped you for that whatsoever, right? Because the movie is purposely as mundane as it can possibly be up until that moment. And
I love having, I mean, subtitles is something I have not had my entire life.
Yeah.
So watching this movie now with subtitles and hearing the products they're talking about, because as a kid, you know, it's hard to pick up a mumbling British accent sometimes, you know. I'd loved, God damn, like that, all that stuff was hitting really hard for, like, I didn't, you know, I mean, I think I understood it as a kid, maybe not the first time I watched it, but in the subsequent million viewings, like I understood like their dynamics, but just the, like the actual products they have, which were probably in 81, like ridiculous over the top. And I'm like, yeah, I could see people owning these.
Right.
Now.
Yeah. You're right. Yeah, exactly. No. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like we have these, like the fucking, what do they call that thing that vacuums around your floor?
The Roomba.
And takes pictures of your house. Right. Yeah. I mean, right. No, I'm kidding.
It maps out your house.
Yeah. Right.
Important. So, yeah.
But no. So, but here's my question though. If your memory is that concise, obviously that fear is easy to remember. Do you remember when you went back into the movie theater? Do you remember liking the rest of the movie?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So it was enough to make you want to watch it again.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And I thought it was hilarious. I mean, I thought all the dwarves were awesome. And I still do. Like, I am still kind of floored at, they're all really good act. I mean, some of them really don't have a lot to act with, but the our main guys like Wally and Randall, I thought they were fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Even now, like Wally has always been my favorite. I love the pirate hat. He's got the best look. When they take the photo, he's got the best smile, like the goofiest look. But yeah, and then guys you never saw in anything. Not that there are, unfortunately, a lot of opportunities in films.
Sure. Well, right. Yeah. And by the way, every single one of them was in Return of the Jedi. Like, that's what you got to take or you can get it.
Oh, God. I can't think of his name now. The guy who played Fidget, that's R2-D2. He's always played R2-D2. Yeah.
And there's the cutest, and I shouldn't frame it like that.
Kenny something?
Yeah. Yeah. There's the cutest scene where towards the end of the movie, like they're all supposed to be like bothered by, like they're freaked out. And Fidget, the actor, is just doing like the cutest little, like he doesn't have a big range of motion. So he's just kind of like dancing, like doing the twist.
And
it's so cute. Like that's probably, I don't mean it like that, but I do.
It is.
So we talked a little bit about the background of this movie, it's pretty easy. Now, I don't know whether these guys plan this stuff out ahead of time, but Gilliam does refer to this as his trilogy of imagination, which includes Brazil and the adventures of Baron Munchausen. So we've got three movies from an artist who, in a lot of ways, is a true artist. And over the past couple of days when I've been thinking about this movie, I've been thinking a lot about graphic artists. And to me, while I'm sure that there are different motivations all across the board, the one thing that kind of resonated with me is that maybe these graphic artists are people that feel so strongly about a world beyond what we see around us that they are compelled to create different universes or worlds in their drawing or sketching or whatever it may be. And that is a really fascinating compulsion.
Yeah.
And the thing about Terry Gilliam is that a lot of artists are very, and I mean this in the nicest way, soft people. Like I remember Madonna talking about Jean-Michel Basquiat, one of my favorite artists. And she said he was too fragile for this world. And that, you know, and sadly what happens there is that oftentimes you have these artists who have this, who maintain this sort of childlike view of the world. And that's where their art comes from. But it's like a diametrically opposed to the harsh realities of the world. So that oftentimes you have like drug and alcohol problems. And then they might start to think that their creativity is fueled by that. And you get into a really vicious cycle. Then you have Terry Gilliam. Who is not a soft artist.
No.
I mean, this guy hates everything.
Yeah.
And he is impassionate and he is just like, you know, I don't like this and I don't like that. And he makes bold stance. He's like, we need those hard artists. Like Tom Berenger is a hard artist. Like you can imagine going into like the first table read of like a movie with Tom Berenger and being like,
can you name one for me?
Well, a Tom Berenger movie, yeah. Platoon.
Oh yeah, that's yeah. right. Major League.
Listen,
sniper, some sort of sniper movie.
If you don't know your goddamn lines, I'm going to slit your throat. Like this is the kind of man that we're talking about. And now this is what I've resorted to, by the way. I used to be good at impressions. Uh-huh. You and a mutual friend of ours got so good and surpassed me that now I have to pick people that no one does impressions of in order to pull it off. But no,
yeah, I don't know if that was a good Tom Berenger.
It's the best one you've ever heard. It's the only one you've ever heard.
True.
Right.
That is true.
Yeah. It's opened a lot of doors for me. And so anyhow, you've got this guy, Terry Gilliam, who's got a really interesting background. And I'm going to be honest with you. At first, as much as I love Python, I was ready to dislike this guy because he's so opinionated. But then I started to love him because of it. And honestly, he detests things with equality yeah. on all sides. So he, you know, he's American, which really separates him from the rest of the Monty Python group. And he grows up in LA and he experiences because he's long haired and he's young and, you know, he's driving his car around. And he's getting roughed up by the police and he's like, fuck this. I'm out of here. And he moves to England. And not only does he move to England and have dual citizenship, but he renounces his American citizenship.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you could say that's for idealistic purposes, probably taxes. But anyhow, that's he renounces it nonetheless. But he's he was anti the Me Too movement. He was really pissed off when the head of like comedic programming for the BBC said that Monty Python could never happen now because you could never have a collection of six white men, you know, in a comedy group.
Right.
And he was pissed. He's like, I've got the quote somewhere. I won't dwell on it, but I'll just say he was like, we've got to have someone from here. We've got to have someone from there. That's bullshit. He's like, fuck it. I'm a black lesbian. He's like, and I mean, so
classic
again, he hates everything.
I identify as a grump.
Yeah. He hates everything, but it's that passion that fuels this imagination to where even if it seems negative that he hates everything, it creates the positivity of him creating new universes outside of ours.
Yeah.
And what he really hated at this time was the consumerism and technology. So we get what is supposed to be a kid's movie here, but with a lot of underlying, I say lightly, you know, cautionary tales about, you know, being obsessed with things. And I remember I was watching this movie in the very beginning and the parents, you know, very purposely not paying attention to Kevin.
Yeah.
And talking, going on, droning on and on about these, you know, keeping up with the Joneses and, well, so-and-so has this contraption.
At least we've got a 2-speed hedge trimmer.
It's hilarious, by the way. Hilarious. And the kid is talking about really fucking cool things. And I'm like, fuck those parents. Right. Like, what assholes? But that's the purpose of the movie, to say, like, you know, if you get caught up in this stuff, you miss, like, all the wonder of the world.
Yeah.
So
great joke when Kevin's like, oh, when he wants to go to bed the second night. And the dad's like, no noise. And he's like, what? Because the TV's up so fucking loud. Right. He has to yell no noise over the blaring television.
Right.
A good subtle joke. I mean, it's a good subtle joke.
It is. It is. And there's a lot of subtle good things in this movie. There's a lot of not subtle things in this movie. But the whole thing came to pass because Python had gained in popularity and success. And, you know, like we've talked about a million times, and I hope it's been a real education for me doing this show to find out about like what it takes to make a movie, and what it takes, by the way, is money. Yeah. That's where it all starts. I don't care who you are. And George Harrison was a fan of Python, and he got together with, what's his name? O'Brien.
Oh,
their producer,
Mark. I don't remember.
Yeah. What the Monty Python,
the producer. Forgettable one.
their agent. And he said, like, okay, let's start a film production company. And by starting the film production company, I can use my money that the British government hasn't taxed by 90%, but I can take my money. And I'm sorry. They wrote a song about it. But anyhow, you know, you got George Harrison. He's well off. He's a big fan. And that's how they financed Life of Brian. And then they started this company with the intention to do other Python-esque projects.
Yeah.
Even if it wasn't like Python specifically. So,
which is insane to think about. I mean, that'd be the equivalent of like, like in the mid 90s, like a member of Pearl Jam starts a production company to make Mr. Show movies.
That's true.
Weird.
It's so weird. Now that you put it like that, and goddamn, why didn't it happen?
Yeah. Stone Gossard, I love Mr. Show.
Yes. God, I just even mentioned Mr. Show today. What a gem that is.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they start this production company and
handmade films, right?
Yes. Yeah. And originally there's this concept for Brazil, which I'll admit I have not seen Brazil. I know it's River Phoenix's favorite film. I've never seen that movie. I've heard people.
All right, see, now here's the thing. You want to talk about collections? At one point I owned every Terry Gilliam movie.
Okay.
I love Terry Gilliam movies.
Well, I'm going to tell you right now. This is I'm going to let you talk about that while I go pee for 1 second. Wow. But here's what I keep forgetting. I'm sitting here and I'm like, okay, I know Terry Gilliam films. They're British and they're muddy and they're sloppy and they're crazy and they're big. But I'm forgetting like fucking Fear and Loathing.
Yeah.
Fucking Holy Grail. Yeah. When I sit down and I look at that, I'm like, holy shit, what this guy has done.
Yeah. 12 Monkeys.
Right. So feel free
Fisher
just for
King.
45 seconds
yeah.
to talk a little bit about how Terry Gilliam films affect you.
Oh, okay. I mean, I think it's like what you were talking about earlier. He has a definite style or aesthetic, or yeah, you see his creativity on the screen. I mean, it was, he's kind of gone through phases of it, but like if you watch early, like his first movie was Jabberwocky. I think he directed that with Terry Jones. I think they co-directed that one. And then I'm pretty sure this was his first solo movie. But yeah, then, you know, Fisher King or Brazil definitely is like, that is peak early Gilliam, the fantastically intricate sets, the overblown yet useless technology, the character still having these, visions of, you know, angelic, he's got like wings and shit like that. So there is this, he always has a fantastical element. Probably once he gets to 12 Monkeys, that's probably his least fantastical movie. I'm trying to think of his other movies.
But what did you think about his growth there, though? Like when it got to 12 Monkeys?
Well, yeah, like, I was
did
like,
you ever think
excited.
He'd rein it in like that?
Well, I, you know, it's like 12 Monkeys feels different. Like if you, because Fisher King is around that time too, and that has a lot of these fantastical elements in it still. I mean, you know, Robin Williams thinks he's a knight and he has to assault this castle, and there's literally a home in New York that looks like a castle.
Right.
So yeah, 12 Monkeys is kind of weird because it feels the least like a Terry Gilliam movie.
Yeah.
But all the pieces set in the future, 1,000% a Terry Gilliam movie.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Like, yeah, his idea, and I get the incorporating like tech, like obsession with technology in this, because that's Brazil. Like Brazil is set in this weird dystopian future with it, just nutso technology that's just useless, essentially.
So that's an ongoing theme of his then.
Yeah. So I can see why he's like that was probably definitely on his mind.
Okay.
So he's like, I'll write another movie, but I'm still putting in, if I never get to make Brazil, at least I'll get to dunk on consumerism for
right.
a little bit and technology. And I mean, to have that vision in 1981 to be like, how poorly technology is going to really work out for us in the long run.
Right.
Pretty good. So yeah, Terry Gilliam. I love so
you've
stuff.
Okay. So you've always been a fan, and they decide-
I didn't watch that one he did with Adam Driver for some reason because I love Adam Driver. But the last one where he did, it's like a movie because he tried making that Don Quixote movie with Johnny Depp. That's like a famous. I think that's just kind of where he lost it.
Yeah,
and I kind of lost it with him.
I think
he just got too grumpy in that at that point in his life.
Sure.
Where he just seemed too frustrated to make movies anymore. Because there's a younger Terry Gilliam who would have worked through anything to make that movie, you know? And maybe there's fun stories about how hard it was to make that movie. But now he just seems like, fuck it. Like, well, I don't need to.
But it's always, the funny thing is it's always been there. Like, imagine having your film financed by a very famous musician who would like to have his music throughout the movie. You disagree with that. He's like, well, I'm at least going to put the fucking song at the end. Mm-hmm. Not only am I going to put the song at the end, but I'm going to put a song in your movie criticizing your poor behavior through the making of this film.
Wait, what song is that?
That Dream Away song. It talks is literally about him being pissed at Terry Gilliam for wasting time and being like obstinate and stubborn. He literally in the lyrics that he wrote for the movie rips on him.
I did not know that.
The best part is that Gilliam is kind of like, fair play. Like,
yeah.
Okay. They, like, yeah, he's like, he could have picked a lot of shittier ways to do that. He wrote a song about it. Right. And so, yeah, like, look at those lyrics. My whole coding thing. I was feeling like there's a weird sort of nonsensical, like, refrain in the beginning of that song that I felt like I was getting something out of it. Like it was maybe an adjusted pig Latin. And if you go online, there are people that have deciphered it, even though they're wrong, because it's just Japanese.
Okay.
It's saying Dream Away in Japanese. Oh. It's basically what it is. But then the rest of the lyrics are about Gilliam being a shithead.
Wow.
Like, just a little bitch about it. But it's interesting. But, he's an artist. And so they make this movie, and he writes it with Michael Palin. Now, let's talk about Monty Python.
Yeah.
And I'm going to start with an easy point here. Do you have a favorite member of Python?
I mean, it always kind of, I'll have moments. It feels so easy to say Cleese.
Do we have to explain to people what Monty Python is?
I hope not. They were a British comedy group from the 1970s. They made three feature films. Four, if you count a sketch movie, have been a very significant part of the comedy scene in history. It was five British guys, one American guy who just did the animation. That was Terry Gilliam, and his animation is very unique. And it was just everything about that show was new and exciting and fresh. People didn't know what to make of it.
And even in the mix of them, there's like dissent within the ranks. There's the Cambridge guys and there's the Oxford guys.
Right, yeah.
So you had Palin and Terry Jones as Oxford, and then the other guys were Cambridge. And Cambridge guys were like a little bit more biting, a little more acid-tongued, taller. also, but then, but they gathered together. And then you had Gilliam, who really, in all honesty, and I read an article today that an interview that he did in 1982, and he just said that, like, really, I mean, he was in Monty Python, but he just really did his animation, and maybe he wrote a little bit of his bits when the rare times that he was in sketches.
Yeah.
But really, he was pretty separate from the rest of the guys.
Yeah. Yeah, he was barely in anything, or he'd play a cameraman, or, very bit parts. He's like, when a Weekend Update guy does a sketch on Saturday Night Live, and you're like, oh, they used to Weekend Update guy. Oh,
right, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, with that comedy, now, for my first experience, I had some friends over, and I sent my dad out, because we were that young, to go pick out some movies, and I think we said we wanted a funny movie and we wanted a scary movie. And I don't even remember what he got for the Scary Movie, but he picked up Holy Grail. And we were all in all of, God, seventh grade?
Yeah.
And we watched Holy Grail and absolutely instantaneously fell in love.
Yeah.
I mean, just even though we probably in retrospect weren't getting all of the political, you know, hints and underlying text, but there's enough like silly slapstick that is part of British humor that we were loving.
Yeah.
And we also got some of the like a little bit headier stuff and like the absurdity. I mean, there's a lot of absurdity in British humor.
Yeah.
So we were loving that and then just became disciples of Python. So that was me in middle school. But by the time that you and I linked up in high school, you had already been introduced to Python.
Yeah.
When did that happen?
Well, my neighbor, famed non
the most famous Nazi,
non-politically next to affiliated know neighbor. Was he had broken his leg or oh no, he like ran through his sliding glass door and had fucked his leg up somehow, and so he was like laid up on the couch.
Wow.
And had rented that movie and was like, you have to come over and watch this bit. And he showed me the Black Knight scene, and I've been fucking all in.
Yeah.
From that moment, I can't remember laughing that hard up to that point, like in my life.
Yeah.
I was just stunned. Like the timing of that scene, the absurdity of it. It's so good. And yeah, we watched the rest of it. And yeah, I'm sure as a kid, I didn't get, you know, the scene with Dennis where they're talking about how different governments are formed, you know,
right?
Like that's going over your head, but there's still something about the feel of it that feels funny, you know? So yeah, then that just started a deep dive into, I got everything I could from Monty Python or Monty Python adjacent. Oh, same neighbor took me to see, his mom took us to see Fish Called Wanda in the theater.
Oh, sure.
And so I was like, oh, these guys again?
These guys
are great. So yeah, I don't know. I kind of remember as a kid Flying Circus being on PBS.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd just sit, like, if my parents were hanging out in their room and it was on and I'd watch, you know. But that never really hit as a kid. And I can't really think about what did from the show.
Well, here's the thing. Like, to me, like, it might not have quite been the exact same thing, but it was sort of empowering to me. Like, in the same way that at that time we, you know, my friends and I, kind of through my sister's influence, started to get into, like, underground music before there was, like, an alternative radio station. Like, when we were listening to The Cure and The Smiths and all that stuff. And we felt like it was just ours. It made you, to be a fan of it, made you feel like you were part of like a group, a cult, you know? And so if you were into Monty Python, it's not like all the other kids on your block were like eating that stuff up at all. But,
and it got to feel like a, you don't get it. Like I get it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right. And, but I mean, the thing is we weren't at the same time though, we weren't just doing it to be cool. Like, we actively chose, like, we'd have sleepovers and be like, oh, we got to get this. We got it. We got to watch Life of Brian or whatever it may be. And or Holy Grail over and over and over and over again to where that timing is starting to sink into your own humor.
Yeah.
It becomes a part of your own fabric. And the thing is, I guess it's what's so great about Python is like what we're talking about, that it's multifaceted, so that there is the absurdity, there is the intellect, and there's also just that beautiful, subtle, like just delivering a punchline, like so gently and perfectly in the moment. It's just fantastic. And really, I started off with an unfair question about who's your favorite, because they all fill a role in that group.
But it's Cleese.
Yeah, it is. I mean, effortless, natural fucking talent.
Yeah.
Absolutely John Cleese.
Yeah.
I mean, here's another fun question. I'm going to let you pick two. What are your two favorite Flying Circus sketches?
Oh, God. I mean, Cheese Shop and I don't know.
Restaurant sketch.
Yeah, I was gonna talk about restaurant sketch. That one is really good.
Cheese shop is
because the Cleese entrance in restaurant sketch is epic, right? God. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it's, I pick.
Listen,
Bookshop, maybe. I know that's just an audio sketch. But
the funniest thing to me is that if you look at guys like our dad's age, their go-to was always the Dead Parrot sketch,
yeah.
Which I like the Dead Parrot sketch, but it doesn't hold a candle to Restaurant and Cheese Shop.
No.
I mean, those two for me, like if somebody's listening and you have no idea what we're talking about, look up Monty Python, Cheese Shop, and Restaurant sketch. Two different sketches, and just enjoy your life for a second. Really, really amazing stuff. So the question that I have to you then is, as you watch this movie, what we're sort of getting is a little bit of Python light. So is that a letdown for you, or are you able to separate?
No, because it's crazy, because watching this movie, it's like I can feel what came from each guy.
Yeah.
Like, I know the Gilliam stuff and I know the Palin stuff. Like, oh, I know, like, Palin is so, he's so smart. And I know, I mean, just any British person knows history pretty well.
Sure.
Oh, God. Oh, I was going to try and think of a story, but I can't even think of what show these guys were on. But it's like some British guys, and they were like on Chelsea Handler's show. God, it's fucking A. It's not like Oingo Boingo, but why can't I think of the show? Anyway, it's going to kill me. But she's talking about some country, you know, and she's like, do you guys know where that is? And they're like, yeah. She's like, how do you know that? And one of them's just like, we went to school in England.
Right. Well,
that's things we learned there.
Great point. And that was something that Gilliam said in this interview that I read, where he's like, British kids read. Like,
yeah.
He's like, that was the tragedy of American kids, is that, yeah, maybe they go out and play and they have their heroes, but British kids are still reading. And that's really what inspired him to write this, because he was over there and he was reading a story to his daughter. And it was it was kind of an updated fairy tale.
Yeah.
And in the fairy tale, like, the wolf didn't eat the grandma, or, you know, the huntsman was just like a door-to-door salesman or whatever it was. And he's like, what the fuck is this? Like, right. Where's the evil? And he's like, because here's the thing. If these fairy tales serve a very good purpose, and that is to educate children about evil and cautionary tales. And if you don't teach them about it, then they're just going to think that the world is happy clappy and round the corner and there they go. You know, like, there's got to be some evil in this.
Mighty Boosh. The guy's from the Mighty Boosh. Thank you. My God. Anyway.
But yeah, but you know,
now pay attention to what you're saying.
But he's got these great quotes where he says, there's no place like home. Clearly there are places better than home. Like, he just wanted.
Wait, who is this?
This is Gilliam.
Oh, okay.
And he just wanted to make a fairy tale in that classic sense with good and evil. Like, if you look at fucking Hansel and Gretel, like, that's creepy. It's terrifying. It's gross. And he wanted to do something that had evil. Now, he had his versions of what evil was, but he wanted to make it happen, and he was able to make it happen with what you said was a $5 million budget. Now, this is interesting. The production company will tell you that it was $12 million.
Okay.
And he gets very pissed about that. And the interviewer that I read asked him, like, why are you so mad about that misrepresentation of the budget? And he's like, because it took talent. To the difference between $5 million and $12 million is huge.
Yeah.
And we did it with $5 million, not $12, because $12 implies, like, sort of an instantaneous quality, right? Or a jump in quality from $5. So he takes that very personally. And he was also asked about the fact that they very explicitly, while talking about these characters or types, that they didn't use God and the devil in it. And he said that that was very much to avoid what they had experienced with Life of Brian, which was a whole lot of pushback.
Oh, yeah.
And
great line with the, he's the supreme being. You mean God? I don't know him that well.
Right? Yeah, that's great. Well, speaking of great lines and comedic performances, David Warner knocked my goddamn socks off. This is a guy. Okay,
this is our fifth David Warner movie.
Right. Yes. And
we saved the best for last.
I swear to God, I thought this guy's whole shtick was being sort of wooden. Uh-huh. Like, I thought that's who David Warner is, that he's like one of those guys, kind of like Tom Noonan, where it's like he seems kind of okay, but there's something like fidgety about him that you don't trust.
Yeah.
And I thought that that's what David Warner's whole gig was. And then I see him in this movie, and his timing and delivery is like, if we're talking about time bandits and jumping time, it's like he's right here, right now. Like, his delivery of punchlines is so modern and awesome.
Yeah.
That I'm like, thank God they didn't get who they wanted. Who's also great is Jonathan Pryce, who's who they wanted.
Right.
Who would have done a fine job.
Yeah.
But they didn't get him because he went on to do some other shitty movie. He was broke and they offered him a lot of money. But
they've both now played Evil Incarnate in different ways, but
That's true.
No one could do it like they did it.
Yes. And he's got this line where he's talking about what he wants to do with the world. And he kind of finishes it with, you know, I have an understanding. And then his minion just says, of what? And he just says, digital watches. Yeah. And I'm like, what? Like, of all the things that could have come out of his mouth at that moment, it was the most hilarious thing.
But in 1981.
Yeah.
A digital watch was kind of like, that technology was kind of exploding.
Yeah. And he's talking about like how God like just completely botched, you know, creation.
Yeah.
And then he has the line where he says, I would have started with lasers 8 o'clock day one. Like,
sorry.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely hysterical. Like, again, like I always talk about how comedy ages, but he is so funny in this. He's got that line about God fucking up creation. He's like, nipples on men. Yeah,
nipples on men.
It's so good. And he's virtually unrecognizable because of the H.R. Geiger inspired
he's got this weird kind of helmet hood,
kind of like the Sleeping Beauty style, like that. Or is that who the Evil Queen, where she's got that sort of like
Maleficent?
Yeah, or Maleficent, yeah.
Yeah.
And but yet it's got that tube off the top, so it's kind of Geiger style.
Yeah. It seems kind of steampunky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you just
go to the notes, Tim.
You just
Tim
said,
just grabbed his notes.
You just said the magic word because I just wrote shitty parents. I just wrote something in here. It's a steampunk's wet dream. And I wrote, what does that say? It's a steampunk's dream. And I wrote the outfits, B, the dwarves. So let's talk about those guys.
Yeah.
Now, there's a technical reason why he had dwarves in this, which is one of my original questions about this, where I'm like, is having dwarves in a fantasy movie innately inappropriate?
Right.
Because it's like associating, like I remember one time I went to a gas station a little bit down the road on near our city, and they had a cigar store Indian out front. And I went in and I went up to the counter and I said, why don't you get some Chinese and black statues out there too, to kind of even it out a little bit, kind of making the point of like, you have a statue out there because you see it as a thing of the past.
Right.
We're still around, you know, like you didn't get all of us. And the poor girl behind the counter is like, what?
Yeah. I just work here.
Yeah. Right. So I started worrying about, like, God, does he just have dwarves because he wanted to make like a fantasy movie, and dwarves were somehow like an intrinsic part of dream sequences,
right,
or anything other than normal?
Yeah, it's not a coincidence all six of your members of this band.
Right. But then what came of that is I did the research, and what he wanted to do was a movie from a child's perspective. But he knew that he couldn't necessarily count on just one child to carry it, that he had to be surrounded by a group that he was a part of. But he still didn't want to change that perspective, that literal perspective of being small in the world.
Yeah.
You know, in the world being bigger than you. Same way when you go back to your old elementary school or whatever, and you're like, my God, this is so small now.
Right.
So he wanted to maintain that perspective of the world being bigger than you, tougher than you, something that you have to overpower to match it. You know, that it's you're the odd man out, you know? And so he just said, well, okay, I'll go with dwarves. And which worked out perfectly, because as the movie goes, like maybe when it first starts, you're like, and all apologies, but when it first starts, you're like, wow, these guys are really cute, you know?
Sure.
But as it goes in a really great way, and I hope I'm not digging myself a hole here because I mean it in the most honest and sincere way, you see them as men.
Right.
You know, and because that's exactly what they are, regardless of their stature.
Right.
There's guys way fucking taller than me, too, by the way. You know, so that it's really neat to see them go from being like a novelty to the characters that they are.
Yeah. Because they are all very unique, too, which is hard to do. I mean, to get six distinct. Right. Am I right? Or
it's
five?
Six. Yeah.
It's six. Yeah. Just to get six very distinct personalities in an ensemble, brand new personalities. Yeah. Not like these are like existing characters that you knew about and are all meeting together. I mean, these are just boom, six brand new people. You easily, like, they don't have like a ham-fisted, like, here's a roll call, blah blah blah. I mean, they almost do that, but it's only, you know, just introduce a couple guys.
Yeah.
And just through actions you understand who the other couple guys are, you know. Like, you understand everyone's role in this group without them having just like ridiculous exposition about it.
And isn't it amazing, like, with you having seen this as a kid, like, it says a lot about just exposure and normalcy, in that when you're a kid and you see this movie, yes, you recognize that these people are smaller.
Yeah.
But in a kid's mind, it's like, okay.
Right.
That's fine. You know, you're not jaded, you're not judgmental as you get as an adult. So I think that kind of like how Sesame Street had different races and that sort of thing, like, which is really good for kids to see, because you get that diversity and you understand, well, the world just doesn't look like this one thing.
Right.
So I think that that was really cool. And I think that as the movie goes on, and I shouldn't even have to say this, but I really feel like it is. I don't think Terry Gilliam was trying to educate the world on dwarves. I really don't. I don't no. think he cared about that. It was more of an aesthetic. But I think that it did, as a like a byproduct, like, have a really neat effect for the fact that, you know, these are real dudes.
Yeah.
You know? And I think it was great that
and
way.
Even right away, I mean, our first time jump, right? We meet Napoleon, a man famously short.
Yeah, right, yes.
And we're able to bring these characters together where he's celebrating their shortness.
Yes.
So immediately, instead of it being a detriment to these guys, in which how it would be, you know, if you made a movie today about six dwarves, it would be their struggles in everyday life.
But right.
Boom, here, immediately, they're like, I'm making you guys my generals because you're small. And you hit each other.
Right. Exactly. And Terry Gilliam, as a director, doesn't make a running joke out of them.
Right.
Like, I mean, yeah, we have a little fun with it in the beginning with the Napoleon thing, but he doesn't treat them as a punchline.
Right.
You know, which I think is great. And Ian Holm, 48 years old, playing a 26-year-old Napoleon. Fine, because Ian Holm is fantastic.
Who knows Napoleon was 26? Was he really?
Yeah. 26. Damn. And he was 5'2". Some people say 5'6", which would have been about the average height of a Frenchman at that time. But, I mean, he was short. We yeah. know that. But, yeah, Ian Holm, fantastic actor. If just to take a quick tangent. If you haven't seen Kenneth Branagh's version of Henry V, see it. Ian Holm has this great, great scene right after this huge battle where he goes up to Henry and kind of after all is said and done, he has this connection with him about being Welshman. Uh-huh. And it's like the most touching thing after you've just seen all this gore and blood and struggle and fight and just these two countrymen come together. It's really, really powerful. And Ian Holm fucking rules. And what's really great is there's this extended drunken table sequence where he just goes on and lists, I swear to God, 12, if not 20 world leaders that were also short,
right,
just to justify his own stature,
all their heights to the half inch.
Terry Gilliam had to leave the set because he was laughing so hard. And it's so good. It's hilarious. And that's the thing. Like, this movie is a lot of fun. I was worried about how I would follow it because it's fantasy, but it does a really good job of, by the nature of them being time bandits, always keeping your attention by doing those jumps.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not really a fantasy movie until like the last third of it where he,
well, that's
where evil
true.
Sucks
it's more
them
historical.
Into the time of legends. Yeah. Yeah. It's a historical
yeah.
adventure. And then it becomes a fantasy horror.
I'm going to go pee one more time.
John, what the fart?
John Cleese, John Cleese is Robin Hood in this movie.
Yeah. Now, a scene I had showed you before, I'll say this as Tim goes to the bathroom. Fun. Yeah.
Okay.
So I had told Tim about this scene because there's a great scene in this film. When our heroes escape Napoleon with all of his treasure, they land in the Middle Ages in England. And it turns out it's during the time of Robin Hood. But before we see Robin Hood, we see his band of merry men. Our heroes are trapped by the merry men. And it is this is the one aspect of Terry Gilliam's aesthetic that I love. And it is this gross, like people are dirty and gross. I want to say scabby, like people look scabby and they're just disgusting, vile people. Like if you look at the poor people in like the peasants in Holy Grail, like this is the era. This is that aesthetic of Terry Gilliam, this gross people. And they're brought into Robin Hood's camp, right? And people are spitting. A guy is ripping people's arms off with like arm wrestling them, right? And they're spitting. It's just disgusting. And then they introduce Robin Hood and it is John Cleese dressed up like a cartoon Robin Hood.
Yes.
Very proper. Like everyone's like, oh, Royal, yeah. There's all this shouting and jolly good. Like, and you know that, and I showed you that. I told you about that scene. I showed it to you. I felt there was a zero reaction the first time I showed it to you out of context. I'm hoping, seeing as you didn't remember it, what was your reaction to that scene?
Oh, I loved it. Okay, I loved good. It. And especially because I had done the research to find out who Cleese modeled himself after.
It's very Errol Flynn Robin Hood.
Well, what he modeled himself after was, I don't know if it was the prime minister or something, but he would, it was like maybe like the Earl of Kent or something like that. But he would like go down the line of footballers to like introduce himself before a soccer match, having nothing in common with these guys. Right. Like he's aristocracy. They're just like run of the mill, just giant burly footballers. But he would just go down the line and like try to talk with them before games. Like, what the fuck are you even saying to these guys?
Right.
And it's kind of like being in a receiving line of like a wedding or something when you don't know anybody, but everybody's coming up to you and you're like, I don't fucking know. But that's what he modeled it after. Just that sort of like fake, you know, I'm just presenting myself. But here's the thing. And this is going to sound like probably the dumbest thing I've ever said. I can't even put into words why Cleese is so good in that scene or why John Cleese is so good in everything. There is something innately that like comes out of him.
Yeah.
That it is funny before he even opens his mouth.
Yeah.
And I don't, the guy has some sort of magic to where he is just like a fine-tuned instrument, the funniest person you've ever known.
Yeah.
And he's just calibrated perfectly.
He is the number one build guy in this movie. And he has a 2.5 minute scene.
Right.
He is number one.
Yeah.
Above the title. That's another crazy thing. The credits for this movie, they put like 5 or 6 people above the title. That's insane.
And by the way,
who all have essentially cameos.
And a pretty interesting, I mean, not to jump back to literally the beginning, but kind of a cool little time or like title card there.
Yes.
Like very geometric.
Oh, speaking of title cards, yes. Evil Dead Rise. Chef kiss.
Okay.
Title card.
We'll get there.
Fuck yes.
I can't
need
wait.
To talk about the rest of the movie, but the title card might be worth price alone.
Well, speaking of things like that, like aesthetics and effects, I was wrestling with a sort of, I don't even know what you would call this. A real kind of like, it was a real brain teaser for me because I'm seeing effects in this movie. Effects to the level of what 1981 could offer.
Sure.
And I'm thinking to myself, why is it to me that some of this stuff that's supposed to be representing futuristic or otherworldly effects still look better than what we can do today? Is it just my memory of seeing something like this for the first time in 1981?
Right.
I'm speaking mainly of the portals opening.
Yeah.
And there's this kind of like little bit laser like outline around it or whatever. It's rudimentary effects for these days. But I'm like, God, it somehow looks cooler.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how to, and maybe it's just my
like
connection.
Like they're grainy. It's weird.
Yeah. Like, it looks,
I know it's because,
realer?
Yeah, we're like trying to overlay films and like, you know, they're not even digitally doing it. Like these are probably hand-drawn things, you know?
Right. But the effects are neat. And we've got Terry Gilliam, who is an artist, and we do get some animation here. And, yeah, you can pick up some of it. There are times where he'll do, like, a really distanced shot, and they're supposed to be moving in the scene from a very far distance, and you can tell that it's animation. But but it's fine. Look, whatever he does that's right in front of your face as far as set pieces is so impressive that everything else is forgiven.
Yeah.
They filmed this in Italy, London, and Morocco.
Yeah.
And you would have thought that they would have gone to 6 other places in this world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. And when they're filming in Morocco, there's a familiar face over there. It's taking it's filling in the backdrop of Greece.
Okay.
And we get Sean Connery.
Oh, okay.
I thought
you were going a little more obscure, familiar face.
Agamemnon.
No.
The funniest part of it being that when they wrote the script and they're talking about the character of Agamemnon, that he's got this helmet on, and that in the script they wrote, when he removes his helmet, it is an actor like Sean Connery or someone of similar recognizability, but maybe more affordable.
Yes.
And it just so happens that the Python agent went golfing and saw Sean Connery on the golf course and was like, hey, are you a fan of Monty Python? And he's like, well, can you give me an of course with
well, of course I am.
There we go. And so he agrees to do the movie for like next to nothing. He gave him 14 days of shooting, and he is fantastic in it. He's so good in it that as Agamemnon, when he sort of befriends Kevin, not even befriends him, he takes him as his son, adopts him.
He's going to inherit the fucking kingdom.
So that when the time bandits take Kevin away, which normally you think would be a good thing, like, holy fuck, they just saved him. It's like,
oh, they're ripping him away. That part is nuts. Like, even as a kid, I was like, I felt bad. I'm like, no, don't take him away from this.
I'm also like what I was experiencing in that moment was kind of going back to that earlier quote that I gave of Gilliam where he said, there's no place like home. Like, of course there's places better than home. Kevin was in the middle of fucking ancient Greece, right. And he's like, I don't want to go home.
Yeah, I love how quickly he's just like, yeah, I recognize how much my parents blow ass.
Right. And so you really feel for Agamemnon when, you know, all of a sudden, like, we don't get to see the rest of the story, but he's probably terribly
No, there is a good moment where you can see him be like, oh, what the fuck's happening here?
Right. And Sean Connery is such a great guy. Like, he is, we think of him as a little bit older guy, just because he's like the first dude that got sexier as he got balder and older.
Right.
But he's always been a badass. The dude is taller than you'd think. He's like probably 6'2", and he was a renowned street fighter in Scotland.
Yeah.
Like, he could kill anybody. Like, he's a genuine tough guy. And he's just like, I don't know, that's... There's something you said earlier, and I'm not going to disagree with you. The dwarves are great in this,
yeah.
And they do exactly what they're supposed to do. However, there are moments when you get more seasoned actors the screen where you're just kind of like, like it's just a little bit more.
I was going to say that earlier. I was going to say, I wonder if, because, I mean, there are parts of this movie where you're just like, how would a child like, you know, it's about fucking history for most of it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what's appealing to a child other than a child protagonist in it? And I'm like, I was thinking now, like, is it these great performances from these seasoned actors? I didn't know who they were as a kid.
Sure.
But, you know, if Ian Holm is not playing Napoleon and it's someone else, you know, I'm probably a serviceable actor, but someone who's not bringing what Ian Holm will bring, or what John Cleese can bring, or what John Connery can bring, you know?
Were they showing you something that you didn't even realize that you loved?
Right, like, exactly.
But you felt it somehow.
Exactly.
Internally.
Yeah, yeah. Is there something that is inherently appealing to me?
Yeah.
That
which is talent. Yeah.
These names wouldn't normally, you know, guys who don't get above the title credit.
Yeah. And yeah, and it the movie does a nice job of balancing that. And the thing is, like I said from the very beginning, and just how ambitious this film is, there was a lot to like for it not really being my jam. Also, I don't want to forget, as we're talking about Napoleon, that great quote of Napoleon's, not in this movie, but just historically.
Oh, what?
Where he wrote a letter to his wife, and he just said, back in 3 days, don't wash.
Oh, God.
He liked it dirty.
Oh, man.
Yeah, which is hot. Anyhow, so also this movie has fur in it. Moving on. So the thing is that I
Who's
got
that fur?
Oh, there's some fur. There's some guys wearing some furs.
Well, yeah, I guess. Oh, yeah, like animal pelts.
Yeah.
Yeah, the merry men, yeah.
I enjoyed that. So here's the thing. By the end of the movie, I mean, I did have some criticisms.
Yeah, I would love to hear criticisms because, yeah, for me, this movie, I've seen it so many times. It's just like, I mean, I could say it's not the best movie ever, but I wouldn't, you know, any criticism I have is just like, I'm like, shut up.
Here's the thing. I and we've said this about many movies before. This one runs pretty close to 2 hours.
Yeah, that's about my only thing.
And I felt like I could chop some time out. I know 20 minutes is like a gargantuan cut. That's probably unfair. And I also get the fact that if you're going to go to extremes to where you have such intricate set pieces with so many extras and so much stuff going on, like, why wouldn't you get your money's worth?
Right.
I get that. Like the banquet in Greece.
Yeah.
Like, we see a bunch of stuff and it doesn't really progress the plot line. We already get the aesthetics.
Yeah.
That's all of that is we don't need more, but we get more. I'm not opposed to that. But because, again, why wouldn't you do that? Why wouldn't you amaze the audience a little bit with some cool visuals and stuff?
Right.
I get that.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. This is the thing by the end of the movie. It's too many screams of dwarves yelling at each other. Like, that that started to weigh on me a little bit to where I tuned out. It took a long time to get there. I was hanging in there, but there's so many scenes of dwarves yelling at each other that I eventually like kind of tuned out a little bit. But, and here's another thing with it being so visually great. There is some of that like early 80s, like choppy cinematography.
Yeah.
But that's just of the time. Yeah. I will forgive that. You know, Spielberg wiped the whole cinematic world clean after E.T. and then we all got smooth after that. But I mean, it's a little choppy.
I think there are little, like you wouldn't have to cut like big chunks of this movie. I think if you started shaving things down, I mean, that adds up after a while. But I mean, still a part of this movie. Like, just I watched it today because Nancy was like, oh, I wanted to watch it with you. So we watched it today. Like the scene where they're escaping from their cell, it takes so long.
Oh, yeah.
But it like feels like it has to. And it feels so intense. And the music is really eerie and you're just kind of getting like piano and some timpani and like, that's about it. Like, especially like right before they start going, like they unlock the door and Randall kind of like falls out.
Yeah.
And is still on it. Like, that's as intense as the music gets in that right. whole fucking scene. But yeah, like it takes a long time, but at the same time, I'm just like glued to it. And I don't know if that's just me.
No, you're right. And the
and
thing
it's
is,
an ingenious way to get out of it. I'm like, oh, wow, that kind of worked.
And here's the thing. I can sit here and talk about shaving time, any given director right now could turn to me and say like, oh, but you'll binge something on Netflix for 6 hours in a row.
Right.
Like, so, I mean, I get it. I think that our attention span should be getting longer. You make a great point where it's like, yes, you could shave it, but you don't like turn away from the screen.
Right.
You know, you're still watching it.
Yeah. In Greece, when they're taking Kevin to the banquet, like that feels a little long.
Yeah.
But it's not like excruciatingly long. There are a lot of parts in this movie that feel just like a hair too long, but in and itself is not. Doesn't take anything away.
Well,
then by 2 hours, you're like, okay.
Let's for just a quick second, as film historians, let's dissect that for a second, because I think I just stumbled on the reason why they might do that. If this film came out in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
So the early 80s. So you're not that far removed, a couple decades earlier, of films being like, those big budget musicals, like picture that big staircase and like, you know, the dancers coming down and like those big musicals and stuff.
Yeah.
The whole thing was about visual spectacle. So maybe that's kind of like a hangover of that, to where it's like, we have to draw people in by saying like, look what a big production we have, you know. Now we're sort of past that now with some like minimalist films that have come out since then, in decades since then, but maybe that's still a bit of a hangover, to where it's like part of film's job for an audience is to transport them to that world, even if to our sensibility it feels like you're hanging on a little too long.
Yeah,
we don't need all that. But maybe at that time it was kind of like, you know, here's the circus and the crazy things going on and, you know, all this stuff. Like, maybe that's just of the time.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting take.
But another, speaking of interesting takes, this movie eventually ends. And I have, and I'll give you a wild guess, what three letters that don't form a word, but a phrase, with a exclamation point and a question mark at the end of my notes, which is WTF. this movie ends, and I was like, what? Seriously? After you just taken me across the globe and through time, you're going to literally do this? And I was pissed for a second, but then I'm like, the fucking balls.
Yeah.
And because we get a very downbeat ending.
Yeah. It's a little Wizard of Oz-ish,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There are, because, yeah, the Are we jumping to the end? We should talk about the Supreme Being real quick. Though,
sure.
Too.
Yeah,
hilarious. I forget who that what that guy's name is. But man, what a proper British gentleman he is.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And I love that take on God or Supreme Being. Nah, I'll just call him God. Just, you know, because he does kind of, I get it, where he's like, I got a lot of shit to do. Like, right. I'm not really
like a CEO.
Concerned with the, yeah, with, you know, the lower level employees, which are people, you know. He could do anything he wanted, but like he doesn't help Kevin in any way.
His most favorite line of mine is where they ask, like, why does there have to be evil? And he just flippantly says, like he literally walks off camera, comes back on for a second to say, I think it has something to do with free will.
Yeah.
Like, it's so good.
It is so good.
It's so funny.
Evil is about to decimate them all. And like Deus Ex Machina God just shows up at the end, freezes him, and is like, yeah, I could have done this whenever. I actually let you guys take the map.
Yeah.
This is a little test. This is like me having fun. But a little chunk of evil gets left behind. They leave Kevin behind. It starts smoking. Now he wakes up. His house is on fire because the fucking one of their appliances went wacky, right?
Yeah.
So you're kind of like, oh, was it a dream? But he's got the photos.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to answer this for the end of the movie. I just kind of enjoy it for what it is. I don't really know how to interpret it the best. Because, yeah. Just kind of wakes up in his bed, which God could do. He could just do that for him. But, you know, it is smoky. So you're like, oh, okay. Like, that's the smoke. But he has the photos still. One of the firemen is Sean Connery.
Yes.
So you're like, oh, you were there, you know.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, they bring out the thing that had caught on fire. It's like a little toaster oven. And it's got that chunk of evil in it. And Kevin recognizes it for what it is. And it's like, Mom, Dad, don't touch it. And because they're fucking assholes and ignore him constantly.
Sure.
They both touch it at the same time and they explode. and then
the
all
movie.
The trucks leave. Yeah, like that's the best part. Like as they explode, then just everyone gets in their truck and drives away.
Right.
And that's how the movie ends. This poor orphaned child left alone in this giant world. He now knows the secrets of the universe, and they are worthless to him as he now has to live his life as an orphaned mortal boy.
Right, yes. No,
it's like I was in the presence of God, and my life is garbage now.
Yeah, right, exactly. and they do kind of play with you along the way because in especially those final sequences with the Supreme Being, you start recognizing set pieces, namely the Legos.
Yeah.
Like these pieces that are supposed to be part of the like structure that, you know,
is the fortress the evil, of ultimate darkness.
Are actually giant Legos. And then like the like laser jet that shows up is one of his toys. So all of these things are the toys that he has in his bedroom. So it would all lend itself to it being a dream because he's just imagining these things from his real life in the dream. But even if it is a dream and he wakes up, the house is still on fire and his parents still die. Right. Like, regardless of if it's a dream or not, his parents are evaporated because they didn't listen to him. But I mean,
and it's such a Gilliam effect, too, where they explode and then kind of reverse into nothingness. Like, their smoke just whoop.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, I don't know. Like, I don't mean it to be any more of a downer note than it is, but maybe that's just a sort of like fast forwarded version of what life is. Like, yeah, your parents raise you, you know, you are who you are. And then, you know, you as the younger generation might have more realizations than they do, but you try to tell them how to make the world better and then they die.
Right.
And then it's up to you.
You're on your own.
So I don't know. But here's the thing. He was questioned, Gilliam, about that ending just left and right. And he's like, well, here's the thing. Adults have a big problem with it. The kids love it. He's like, any kid that I've heard of, that's their favorite part of the whole movie, that the parents explode into a pile of dust. So, yeah, I don't know. Like,
it is kind of amazing how there is literally no empathy for the parents or any... Even when they first get to the fortress to find the most fabulous object in the world, and it's the guy from Moulin Rouge is the TV host, and just when Kevin sees his parents there, like, he's like, oh fuck, this is a trap.
Yeah, right.
Like, exactly. He's not like excited to see his parents. He like sees them smiling and is like, oh, something's very wrong.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And Jim Broadbent, that actor,
yes,
is being so awesome and creepy and perfect in that role. Yeah, it's
this
interesting.
This game show is your money or your life.
Yeah, right.
There is a part where do they kill a guy? They dunk
yes,
him in custard yeah,
literally,
and he
yes,
dies.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what happens. It's so good. And so, yeah, like, you know, I mean, again, this was Gilliam saying, like, there's evil, like fairy tales weren't always pretty. And you can even picture exactly what the ending of an American version of this would be. It would be everything that we saw. The house is on fire. They're losing everything. They go outside. The parents are sitting on the curb. And Kevin starts talking about something. The parents have already lost everything. They realize that their material possessions are gone. So now finally, maybe his dad says, what was that? And yeah. Then Kevin says, well, you know, this happened. He's like, tell me more. Like, and then the camera
they
pulls
sit down
away.
On the yeah, curb. Exactly. Yeah.
The camera pulls away and then everything is perfect. Yep. But that's America. And this is Terry Gilliam who hates the world. And, but I mean, you know, I guess that's what makes it what it is. I mean, I will give this movie credit for being extremely unique in the pantheon of both fantasy, historical, certainly children's films. It is, I don't know if Wizard of Oz has ever truly, truly met its match as far as like, if you really imagine the time that was made in.
Yeah.
This movie comes real close.
Wow.
I mean, if I had to pick one,
yeah.
I mean, there is Neverending Story, which is fun, and I love that movie.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm gonna, you know, if I had to sit here and somebody asks, which do you like better, Time Bandits or Neverending Story? Of course, my connection is to Neverending Story, but Time Bandits is
David Warner in that?
No,
kicking ass? No,
no, no, he's not. And here's the thing:
is anyone in that movie?
Not really. I sit here and like
the guy who rides the snail who eventually becomes the Oompa Loompas. It might be the most famous guy
maybe.
In that movie.
Yeah, maybe.
And they don't even let him use his real voice in Neverending Story. It's dubbed over.
That's right. You know, what's so funny looking back at some of those movies now, like as a kid, you're just like, well, a movie is a movie is a movie. But then you look back and you're like, there are parts of Neverending Story that are just sort of weird, like that sort of like European style way of yes. filmmaking. Like it's just bizarre,
yeah.
You know, feels surrealistic. But no, this, I think that I'm not going to sit here and say, I can't believe this movie did as well as it did.
Yeah.
Cause I get the scope of it. And that's undeniable, but it certainly isn't, it's not sugarcoated.
No.
I
was actually kind of surprised at its box office, because I feel like it's not a movie. I feel like I just fucking yelling into a void when I talk about this movie to anyone who's not my brother and our friend Tom, who's my neighbor now, but I've known him my entire life. We watched this movie. He watched this movie a billion times.
And on top of that, even if you do get somebody that is like, fuck yeah, that's awesome, they're probably thinking of Ice Pirates. And no connection there. Time
Herpes.
Bandits, Ice Pirates, but they're probably thinking of Ice Pirates.
That was on HBO.
Yes, it was. Oh, I saw that one in the theater, too.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. But no, I look, this is a horror podcast, and it always will be.
Yeah. Let's talk about the guards those little horse head things with the hook arms.
Yes.
Those are terrifying.
Yes, they are.
You want to talk about some horror.
And you're exactly right. Like, that's the kind of, like, nonsensical thing that would be in a nightmare.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, kudos to him. Here's the thing. Here we are talking about horror movies, or you know, typically we do. I'd love to see an out-and-out Terry Gilliam horror movie. Holy shit.
Hell yeah.
It'd be disturbing as all get out.
Yeah.
But no, I don't think it's out of place. First of all, it's your birthday. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah. I'm done trying to justify this.
Yeah, no, it's great. It was a fun choice. It's off the beaten path. And I think that seeing it with the nice restoration, things are nice and crystal clear. I think a lot of people out there would enjoy this movie. And look, we're in a time period right now where fucking fantasy or like ancient historical things are fucking huge.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe it might not be your, you know, Game of Thrones or Lord of the Rings or whatever. But if you like any of that stuff, you're probably going to be okay with this.
Yeah. This movie's awesome.
It's very unique. There's not like...
Oh, what did you... Let me jump back real quick, because I did want to know, like, what you kind of thought about the movie when it did take that hard fantasy turn. Because, yeah, there is a... it's when they're on the Titanic, and the Titanic sinks. Hilarious setup to that. Waiter, champagne, lots of ice.
Yeah, right.
And then they... how was he supposed to know?
Right,
exactly. It was going to sink. That's pretty funny. But, yeah, so then evil sucks them, like, into the time of legends. And they end up on an ogre's boat. So were you just like, what the fuck is happening now? Like, what do you think about like the ogre scene? Because we go from an ogre and Catherine Hammond. What's her name?
Mona.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mona.
Yeah.
Who he then uses in Brazil. She's in Brazil. She's fucking awesome in Brazil. But yeah, so you've got like this ogre couple. And then a giant with a ship on its head. What's going on with you while you're watching the movie?
Be honest with you that because the movie had taken the leaps that it had taken, as I'm sitting here listening to you say that, now I can register a little bit more of a definitive line between the two parts of the movie that way. But to be honest, as I'm watching it, like, because we're jumping these time periods and we're going into these different fantastical places, it seemed pretty seamless to me.
Yeah.
Like, I guess, yeah, now that you say that, it's like, well, yeah, we went from, while it might seem otherworldly to talk about, you know, to put ourselves in Napoleon's time or Robin Hood or whatever, that's still historical versus mythical stuff.
Yeah.
But to me,
Now that I'm thinking about it, like, Robin Hood is not, that's a story.
Right. Exactly.
And also Agamemnon fights a Minotaur.
Right. Exactly. true.
So maybe that's it. Like, it already through the historical stuff has a little,
that's what I felt,
planet like of fantastical elements.
That's what I felt like. It felt seamless to me that way.
Cause I would say it wasn't until I was older where I really understood, like, they were like leaving Earth's timeline and going to another place. Like, as a kid, I was just like, oh, this is really long ago when maybe these crazy things roamed the planet.
I'm going to be honest. I'm not sure that I even understood that was happening until you literally just asked that question two
right.
minutes ago. Like literally, like, it all kind of fell together for me. I didn't dislike it at all. I mean, I guess now that it's in front of me, I probably liked more of the real world stuff a little bit better. But, here's the thing.
Those parts had real actors.
Right.
Not weird little elephant people.
Right. But part of this movie's charm is that it always keeps you guessing.
Yeah.
Like, you can say, like, oh, I bet they'll go here next, or I bet this will happen next. You can't call it. If you don't know it, you can't call it.
A lot of potential there.
Yeah.
Did you know there's rumors of a series?
I did hear a little bit about that. And who is looking at doing that?
Taika Waititi.
That would be something.
Who is either ready to do something great or has peaked. I'm not sure yet.
Yeah. I think, well, here's the thing. If there were ever to be a tapestry upon which you could add your own take, adding to what is already an amazing accomplishment, it would be Time Bandits.
Yeah.
You can go anywhere. You can do anything. You can still stick with that. I think that there is enough of an element in New Zealand comedy that is brothers in arms with British.
Yeah.
That I think that it would, the tone would carry over nicely.
Yeah. Like, I guess if I had to like pick someone, he's not someone I'd be like, oh, I doubt he gets it.
Well, and think about what you could do with it. Like, maybe the whole goal is that it's Time Bandits has already been a kids movie.
Yeah.
Why not kind of keep that as a sort of like facade, but take it further and make it for adults?
Yeah.
Like, why wouldn't you? What the fuck does a 6-year-old know about Time Bandits right now? Nothing.
Right.
If you make, if he update, not, I don't mean updates it like modernizes it, but I mean, if he takes it further, makes it more closer to like an R-rated thing, is there going to be a 7-year-old out there saying that they've like molested Time Bandits? Right. From what he knew?
Took away what, yeah, I love.
This isn't my Time Bandits,
right?
You know, from 2017 or whatever, like when he first saw it. But no, I think that that's really cool. I think that it's a universe worth exploring. It's endless.
Yeah.
So I think that
I mean, he's going to take him to 1940s Germany.
Oh, sure.
As a guarantee.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he's going to be like,
maybe 30s. Like, I feel like he'll throw in, like, they go to his art school or something like that.
And he might be like, I'm not sure if that giant was supposed to be Maori, but he kind of right. looked like that's what you were going for.
Yeah.
Let me go ahead and fix that for you. But no, I think he'd be great for that. And I think that it's a story worth continuing. Normally I don't look, here's the thing. There's no parameters on this universe.
Yeah.
On the Time Bandits universe. So I think that if I were to pick anybody, I mean, it would either be him or the, oh God, what's his name? You know,
you're doing jazz hands?
With the eyes on my palms.
Oh, Guillermo del Toro. Yes. Yeah, that'd be pretty cool.
One of the two. And join forces.
Yeah.
That, like, those two guys could eke something out. It would be different directions, but yeah, there is a there is a place to take this, though. And I wouldn't think it would be corrupting. If anything, it might just be continuing what is like the heart of this movie, which is like that constant exploration.
Yeah.
I mean, this movie is about, well,
so much even to be explored in the, you know, because they, and I do like this concept where you kind of set up the afterlife as kind of this bureaucracy, like the Time Bandits were just employed, like they were in charge of creating vegetation and shrubs and shit.
Kinda.
And they made a gross tree and they got fired. And right. So they were like, oh, fuck you. We're just going to be Time Bandits now.
Yeah. They're basically, I mean, there's a word for it, angels. Like that, they're basically right,
yeah.
angels.
Yeah.
So, which is really neat. And I love the fact that they didn't like spell that out too specifically.
Right.
Like that they just allowed it to be its own universe, but still making it the scope of gods and devils and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
No, I would love to see and rarely do I ever be like, you know, can I ever take something that is this unique and this special in whatever the universe it's created and say, yeah, let's open that up. But my God, if there was ever anything, it would be this.
Yeah.
I'd love to see
I mean,
see
they
that.
Never get, we find out that there's a giant hole that can take you anywhere. We
yeah.
never get to it. It's just forgotten about.
Hey, when
would you like a giant hole that could take you anywhere?
Sure. Sure. Yeah, I'd go in there. Yeah. Yeah.
You want to hear kind of something sad about this movie?
Oh, sure.
Just for, as they a all personal died. Experience. Well, they are all dead now. Randall died very shortly after. He was only like 38 when he died.
Oh, wow.
But all the other guys kind of lived pretty long lives.
Yeah.
I think Wally died in like the late 90s.
Okay.
But they all died, you know. They lived to like 60 or 70, a lot of them.
Okay.
So, you know, of course, this movie has, you know, I associated it with my dad and like this experience I had with my dad. And one year I found like online, like the map, like the big printed version of the map.
Oh, awesome.
And I gave it to him for Christmas and he hung it up in his office at his house. It's hanging the wrong way. Well, that's just, you know, like, oh, well, I guess it's more important to me.
Well, no, but I mean, who knows where you'll go if you go about it that way.
It's subjective when you look at that map, but it's definitely supposed to, like, it's supposed to lay lengthwise.
Yes.
He's got it vertically.
Right. Well, I mean, it's all, I don't know enough about math or physics to know, but I figure you could probably still get to where you're going.
Right. Yeah. But, you know.
Right. Yeah.
I was just like, oh. Yeah. Oh, well, I got over it real fast.
Don't invite Terry Gilliam over there. He'll burn the place down. Right. Absolutely. No, I'll be honest with you. In the days leading up to watching this, I would start thinking about the fact that I was going to start watching this, that I was going to, and I'd get really tired.
Oh, man.
I'd get sleepy. Like, just at the thought of
I've had that feeling before.
I settled in. I was by myself. I was like, I'm going to do this. And I'm going to enjoy it, or I'm going to try to. And it was pretty effortless. I mean, it doesn't have to be your favorite movie. The movie is so striking visually that you're going to enjoy yourself. And there's enough of those bits with your John Cleese, with your David Warner peppered throughout to where nobody's going to be like, that movie sucked.
Right.
You cannot say that the effort sucked in this movie. You just cannot.
I was kind of surprised at the 90% this movie has on Rotten Tomatoes.
Really?
Again, because no one fucking talks about it ever. But yeah, I mean, of course, it's Rotten Tomatoes. That can mean they were all 6 out of 10s, but they still enjoyed it, right?
Right.
I guess the thing we forget about Rotten Tomatoes, it's just an aggregate. That doesn't mean 90% of the movie is good. It just means 90% of the people liked it.
Lord knows we have gushed about films that I'm sure had a very low Rotten
Tomatoes. Oh, yes, yes.
I was just today I was thinking about just how much you loved Hide and Go Shriek, and just how the feeling of just pure pleasure and joy that washed over me when you said that it was a masterpiece.
So bad it's a masterpiece.
Yeah, right. Yes. No, I enjoyed watching this, and I will bite my tongue, you know, if this movie ever comes up again to say like, that's not really my thing. I had a good time watching it. I really did. Am I going to run out and say like, what other stuff like Time Bandits is there? Like,
right.
Probably not.
Well, there's not.
No.
That's kind of the awesome thing about it too.
Right. Yeah. I liked it.
Yeah.
I had fun.
Watch Brazil. I mean, I would definitely say watch Brazil.
I will. Yeah, I will.
Jonathan Pryce.
Whom I love. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where are we at?
Yeah, we could probably wrap it up.
Okay.
This is good for a birthday episode.
Yeah.
You recommend it? I recommend it.
Yes, I do. I do. I'm happy
to hear that, because I know you just, it doesn't seem like you were very excited about watching
I wasn't.
This. But I knew it was good. When I watched it again, I was like, no, this is a good movie.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's an experience. It really is. It might be fun. I'll tell you the truth. It might be. I mean, I had a fine time watching it on my TV. It actually might be nice to go, like, if it comes to the music box or it's on the big screen, that might be kind of fucking badass.
That would be. I would rearrange my plans for that.
Yeah.
Like, just watching this, like, the number of lines from this movie that, you know, I probably don't use them contextually, but they run through my head in certain scenarios. Like, I live on a one-way street. Anytime I see someone going the wrong way, I hear the woman from Italy going, "You're going the wrong way!" Like, just the opening line where the dad comes up and is like, "What the hell is going on up here?" Like, me and Tom said that, like, we would purposefully fuck around so that you could bust into a room and go, "What the hell is going on up here?"
That's awesome.
It's incredible just how many lines from this movie have crept into my brain and lived there.
That's the beauty of rewatching these things. Honestly, like, we have no idea how much it woven into the fabric of ourselves these movies and these lines are.
Yeah.
You know what's really where I really notice it in an interesting way, and I hate to even admit this because I'd like to take credit for all of it, but there have even been things where I've made choices as an actor on stage and then like watched a movie and been like, oh shit. Right. I kind of lifted that, didn't I? Well, completely unintentionally, but it happens. I recommend this absolutely, especially like, I don't know, 15 years ago, maybe not. I would have still recommended it, but I think that people would have been like, it's fine.
Yeah. But I think if you watch this too in our like height of Python,
yeah,
there's enough crossover.
Sure. I think that the Palin
Shelley Duvall.
Yeah, those scenes were, I mean, they're funny, and she's just such an interesting person to look at that it was fine. But it's kind of like
I wonder if there's one more scene with them that was cut out.
Yeah,
because they only show they're like a recurring character, but only twice.
Right. I remember one time I was in a show and I don't remember what it was. Maybe it was Charlie's Aunt, which was kind of a British show, and it's a farcical sort of thing. And I remember the director being like, "Look, if you're going to ad lib a line, put it out there." Like, don't just like I'm going to sneak this one in or whatever. Like, if you're going to say it, say it. So that's kind of what I think of when I think of those two in this movie, where it's like, yeah, their bits are funny. They're interesting. But I'm with you. Is there another scene in there? Can we like maybe amp up the comedy a little bit more? I think that they're kind of like a funny little add-in.
Yeah.
But it's almost like the joke should come from a little bit more.
Right.
Like the comedy should come from the frequency.
Right.
So if the fact that they were like seeming to be showing up everywhere, but then dropped off, felt like the joke died a little bit.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would have liked that. Plus, and I'm seeing.
Also, it's where do you put them? Greece.
Also, it's like, I mean, it's not Mia Goth, but it's like, it's nice to see her in anything. Like, I mean, it's as close as we can get. And I do see that more and more. I do.
Good.
Remake the whole thing just for Mia Goth to be in those two scenes. And we're all set.
Oh, yeah. She could be in it. All right.
Well, let me ask you this question.
All right. Ask me.
If we remade this movie now,
yeah,
would anybody have a problem with there being six dwarves in it?
Man, I'm sure when
Peter Dinklage
saw the article that they were going to make a TV series, he was like, ugh.
"Well, he's pissed off right now about a live action Snow White."
Yeah,
so I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question.
It is, because it feels like that is kind of what makes this movie what it is, without beating you over the head with it and not like demanding that's what makes it unique or important, right. You know? I don't know. But at the same time, what's wrong with giving six actors work that normally wouldn't get it?
That's a very great point.
Yeah.
Yeah. And good work,
too. Let's showcase them.
Yeah. I'm all for
Maybe if they're a little more diverse, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
We don't have Terry Gilliam direct it.
Yeah, exactly.
He'd be like, what?
Right. Just everyone explodes in the first 15 minutes. He makes a short. But no, that's it was funny. We were talking today at work about somebody came up with the idea, or it wasn't even came up with the idea, but there was some discussion about there being a Taxi Driver 2, which is preposterous.
Yeah.
But I'm like, what if they do? Because like, if you remember at the end of Taxi Driver, like Robert De Niro is alive.
Uh-huh.
He picks up Sybil Shepherd. She's in the back of the cab. And then it has this weird sort of like he takes off. And like, you know, it's strange. But what if they made a Taxi Driver 2? Scorsese directs. Everybody's still alive, right?
True.
But they make it like a 15-minute short where it's just like the next 15 minutes. And then that's it. Like, everybody on board, full production, 15 minutes.
15 minutes.
Perfect.
Just driving her home.
Yes. Taxi Driver 1.5. That would be great.
Green light it. Okay. Let's wrap it up.
Yes.
That was Time Bandits from 1981. I'm glad I got you to watch this movie. We'll never talk about it again. Join us next week. We're going to right this ship, goddammit. Because we went from comedies to this movie. So we're going to start a new miniseries. It's going to be May, Mother's Day. And what's more important than mothers? Mm. So please join us for the start of our new miniseries. We're calling Mom May.
Yes.
This is awesome. And we're going to start it with the 1968 film Rosemary's Baby.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, did you just say it's going to be made like as if it was nothing?
Yeah. Is that a big deal?
The it's going to be May. Oh. like you just like it was nothing. Yes.
I know. That song just doesn't register with me. You know? I mean, I know. Yeah. When you say that, I'm like, holy shit. But yes. Yeah, like my kids never really listened to them.
No.
No.
But here comes Mom May.
Yeah, Mom May.
Yes.
Movies about moms.
I have never seen Rosemary's Baby.
I've seen it one time. It's good. And the great thing about it, nothing problematic about it. We can just coast through and there'll be nothing we got to dance around.
No.
Just have a good old conversation about a classic film.
I can't wait.
No one involved
in
any way.
Frank Sinatra, nowhere to be found.
Yeah. Charles Grodin's first movie. This will be exciting.
Really?
Charles Grodin.
First movie. Okay.
I believe so, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's next week. Rosemary's Baby.
Can't wait.
Please check out our website, slumberpodcastmassacre.com. Shoot us an email, slumberpodcast@gmail.com. I made a joke about it. Please check out our LinkedIn page that we do have now.
Yes.
Do we really?
We really do.
Made a LinkedIn page before you made a Facebook page?
Yes, I did.
God damn.
I made a LinkedIn page. I tried to make a post, but then I realized that I was making the post from me personally. So then I erased it, and then I made the post the right way. But it still showed both of them. So then I ended up erasing both of them. So
yeah. Was it like, this show is great? I agree.
Right.
Dude, you forgot to log out of your account.
So yes, we do have LinkedIn, by God.
All right. Perfect. I think that should be our bit. We just like nothing, no important social media, just the joke ones.
Right. That's our Bill Murray's 800 number. Right. We just communicate through LinkedIn.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry. You got a recommendation? Look us up on LinkedIn.
Perfect.
It's the only ones we'll take seriously. Huge thanks to our patrons. You help make this show possible. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you so much. Please join us next week. Rosemary's Baby. Tim, do you have anything else to say about Time Bandits?
I don't have anything else to say about Time Bandits, but I do have something else to say about your birthday, and that is that I love you.
Oh.
And I'm so happy that you were born.
Thank you so much.
And that here's the thing. I've thought about. We emotionally prepare ourselves for trauma before it gets to us.
Yeah.
And while I've imagined you eventually, it's not going to happen, but of ending this show, that you would say, you know, I think that you should go on by yourself. You really enjoy this and you really shouldn't give up on this just because I'm not going to be there anymore. That is fucking bullshit because it doesn't work without you. And I love you. And this show only goes on as long as you and I are together. And I'm thrilled that you were born and you're my sweetest friend. And I love you with all my heart.
The show is like the opposite of the jaunt.
Shorter than you think, Tim.
Oh, no.
Shorter than you think.